Court of Diamondback Firearms v. Salio, Inc. Mr. Santuri, you want 3 minutes for rebuttal? Okay. Wait 1 second for Mr. Spears to say. Okay, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Ryan Santuri, and I represent Diamondback Firearms, the appellant in this case, and the DEC action plaintiff in the lower decision. Your Honor, there are 3 issues before the Court today, the first 2 of which relate to claim construction. First, did the district court err by refusing to specifically define the term half-cocked within the context of the 914 patent? An interrelated issue is whether the half-cocked, the term half-cocked is actually invalid for indefiniteness. And then finally, the third issue is whether the trial court erred by denying JMOL with respect to invalidity by both anticipation and obviousness.
Now, are either of these claim construction issues dispositive with respect to the question of validity? Or
certainly with respect to the, in the context of indefiniteness, they would be dispositive of it, because one of the issues is whether the trial court erred in not finding half-cocked.
Okay. Say we don't find that was an error.
Yes, Your Honor.
If we disagree with either of the claim constructions, does that affect the validity issue, or does it only affect infringement?
It may affect both, depending on whether the court selects another construction or whether the court remands to the district court for a new construction.
Well, say we adopt your construction.
Then yes, Your Honor, it would impact infringement. It would likely not impact the validity issue.
You didn't ask for any relief by way of a new trial.
I believe
you only asked for it on non-infringement.
I believe we did ask for a new trial with respect to claim construction for purposes of non-infringement, but neither side really conceded that the primary reference, the Glock patent, disclosed a half-cocked position to the extent that one understands what that term means.
Okay, so just so I got it, if we disagree on one of the claim constructions, then you get to argue infringement again.
Yes,
is that what
Your
you're saying? But the validity issues are separate.
I believe so, Your Honor.
Except the indefiniteness.
Except for the indefiniteness. Well, there is at least one potential construction that was advanced during the trial court that would impact validity as well.
That's not on appeal here.
No, it's not, Your Honor. However, if the court remanded and that construction was adopted by the court on remand, then it would change the nature of the validity analysis.
That claim construction that you claim is driving the invalidity issues isn't in front of us.
Well, Your Honor, that's part of the reason why we're here, is that we didn't really have a construction to go on. We had the denial of Diamondback's construction, but beyond that, the court refused to take any further steps in construing the claims. In fact, the court's order said, I'm denying Diamondback's construction, but I'm stopping my analysis there. And so what we were left with at trial was Diamondback in a position where it couldn't really discuss the meaning of terms, it couldn't advance its own constructions, while the CARS representatives, CARS expert could say, on the one hand, it's not a well-defined term. Then later he said it can be anywhere in intermediate, the fully cocked and striking position, but when faced with the Dunn reference, he said, well, actually it's not anywhere, we actually have to shift that position some, because otherwise that would overlap with Dunn. And that's where I say that to the extent that there was a construction provided that's similar to one of Mr. Bradbury, Carr's experts, if that construction were adopted by the court on remand, then that would actually change the analysis of one of the references. Unfortunately, we could never really, that was one of many scenarios that could never play out, because despite the arguments advanced during claim construction and the testimony at trial, the court continued to refuse actually selecting a term or a definition for the term half-cocked.
Okay. So I assume that your firearms hold somewhere in an intermediate position, but not exactly in the middle. Right?
Yes, Your Honor. So the Diamondback firearms were designed to have an intermediate, so the position is intermediate, the fully cocked and striking position. However, by design, it was intended not to have any spring compression at that intermediate point. And so it wouldn't infringe if the court determined that the midpoint was required as part of a half-cocked definition. I believe that it also wouldn't infringe.
You're going to maintain in a half-cocked position by something other than the spring.
Your Honor, well, that's part of the issue. Is
no, but I mean, Judge Miles was just asking you about your device.
Yes, Your Honor. And the device is, so when you rack the slide, the cocking and releasing element moves from one side of the striker to the other. However, it's not really engaged at that position as the firearm is designed. And so there's no spring pressure there. There's actually, depending on the tolerance, how the tolerances stack up, there's actually can be a little bit of movement there to where it can float. And so that's really part of the construction that was advanced, is the notion that both sides agree that to cock a firearm means to compress the spring, to get it into a position so that it can discharge the firearm. And if you are, when we are talking about cocking a firearm, as it's described in the 914 patent and in the art, the idea is you're compressing the spring such that there's enough energy there so that it can cause a detonation if the striker is released.
But your gun is half cocked without any spring compression.
Well, Your Honor, we take the position that it's not half cocked.
Well,
it's in a ready-to-fire position.
Assume, for purposes of argument, on the half cockedness being in the midpoint as opposed to someplace else, assume we agree with the district court on that piece of the construction, and that what we're concerned about is whether or not the spring has to be partially compressed at all times.
Right, then it would not infringe under it. Would
just
it,
for
right.
purpose of claim construction, because I think your claim construction argument is that the spring has to be in the half cocked position. It's maintained in that position by the spring.
Exactly right, Your Honor.
Now, if you look at the claim language disagrees with you.
Well, and I disagree with the court on that.
Can will you look at the claim language?
Yes, sir.
At the top of column 5 in claim 1. But claim 1 has gone through the litany of all the parts that are in the machine, talking about the first biasing means, which is the spring. And it goes down, then it begins to talk about a cocking and releasing element, which is step 21, is down there where the cam is, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the claim goes on to say that said cocking and releasing element in said first position, maintaining said striker in the half-cocked position.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the what is maintaining the half-cocked position is not the spring, not the first biasing means, it's this. And in your briefs, you sort of recognize that and you say, oh, well, it may not be directly, the spring may not be directly, but it's indirectly maintaining.
Well, it's only maintaining the position if there is spring pressure on the other side. So the striker is flanked on one side by the cocking and releasing element.
My point is, why wouldn't a person of ordinary skill reading this language understand that the half-cocked position is not maintained by the spring?
I believe that it has to be maintained by both the spring and the cocking and releasing
but
element.
Wouldn't you think then the language would have said cocking and releasing element and related elements, or said cocking and releasing element in conjunction with the first biasing means maintains the striker in the half-cocked position?
No, Your Honor. Respectfully, I disagree with that.
Wouldn't that have been nice and clear language to support your point of view?
Well, I think that this claim could have been written in a lot of ways that would be more clear for us.
If you've got a public notice function of claims, and I'm about to go out and make a new gun, and I need to know whether or not the spring element is what's going to hold the gun in the half-cocked position, or what am I going to infringe?
Your Honor, I think the description of half-cocked position is where spring pressure goes into there. There's no reason to say that it's maintained by both the cocking and releasing element and the spring, because it's maintained in said half-cocked position. And if you step forward or I'm sorry, step further back in the claim, it describes that that it's the cocking and releasing element is movable into engagement in its first position when the striker is in a half-cocked position, intermediate the fully cocked and striking position. And so Diamondback's argument really is that within the term half-cocked, necessarily there is spring pressure there, and that's why you don't need to, when you go further down in the claim and say that it's maintaining it.
But it doesn't need to be so. I mean, your own gun proves it doesn't need to be so.
Well, that's why Diamondback contends that it doesn't have a half-cocked position.
Where in the claim language does it say half-cocked includes spring compression?
It doesn't. However, what the claim says is that it's in a half-cocked position, intermediate the fully cocked and striking position.
That means somewhere in between.
Well, I think that there are two pieces there. There's no reason to call it half.
You think that means exactly in the midpoint?
I think that that means midpoint and spring compression. I think both of those...
Why the latter?
Why?
Intermediate, okay, between the two.
Right.
Judge Hughes is asking, why does that necessarily mean you have to add in the spring pressure?
Because there's...
Is it because cocked means that the spring is compressed so that it will let the gun go, so half-cocked must mean that the spring is half-cocked?
Exactly, Your Honor. So the whole action of cocking the weapon is compressing the spring to store energy and allow it to discharge. It's not cocked at all if there's no spring pressure, but has no capacity to fire.
So there's no intermediate cocking at all in your device?
Exactly, Your Honor. It was designed to such that in that intermediate position, it still doesn't have spring compression. And that's really the point of...
But it would be, if we agreed with the district court judge, it would be within the definition of half-cocked.
That's true. If this court decides that half-cocked is intermediate, it means the same thing as the claim language that says intermediate the fully cocked and striking position and does not require any spring pressure or the midpoint, then yes, Diamondback's firearm had a half-cocked position, and that's how we ended up here. Diamondback's position is that you can't half-cocked position and intermediate the fully cocked and striking position cannot mean the same thing because there's no reason for both of those phrases in the claim language they are effectively redundant. If half-cocked means intermediate the fully cocked and striking position, and we already have that limitation as part of the claim, why say it twice? I mean, essentially what you're doing is saying that you're engaging it in an intermediate the fully cocked and striking position, intermediate the fully cocked and striking position. And that's not, that doesn't provide, it basically scraps the language half-cocked out of the claim altogether, and this court has it. We've cited a number of cases in our brief that suggest that every term has to be given some meaning. Why even use the term half-cocked?
Why isn't that just defining what half-cocked is? I mean, at the bottom of claim, I guess, 67, line 67, column 4, to the top of column 5, it just says, to a half-cocked position, intermediate, said fully. Isn't that latter phrase, intermediate, just further defining half-cocked?
No, Your Honor, I believe that there are two separate components. So I think you have the striker has to be intermediate, the fully cocked and striking position. But if half-cocked has no further meaning, why is that term in there at all? Why say half-cocked at all if the only requirement for a half-cocked position is language already found in the claim?
Well, I mean...
So it's your point is that the fact that it says that it's cocked means there has to be some...
Exactly,
Your
Honor.
Forget the half.
Exactly. Okay. And the problem that we had in this case is that we had, on the one hand, we're told that it's a unique term that has some special meaning, but then, I mean, in Carr's own, in their red brief, in one site section, they tell you that it has a unique meaning that's specific to this industry. Later, on page 19, elsewhere, they say it has common meaning that's just intermediate, the fully cocked and striking position. Further on,
which
on page
30... Which is consistent with the claim language.
I don't believe it's consistent unless you're going to disregard some of the terms in the claim language. But, Your Honor...
I don't understand why we have to disregard half-cocked. It just... I mean, they're using it as a shorthand for intermediate between fully cocked and not.
Then there was no reason to say intermediate
yes,
fully cocked.
Yes, you're suggesting that every patent is written without any superfluous language at all, and I think we know that's not the case.
Well, I'm suggesting that this court on a number of occasions has said you can't just disregard the terminology, and certainly the back and forth.
But if we read half cocked as defined by intermediate set position, we're not. It just that's what it means. And they said it one way, and they restated it another way.
As the court explains, they have restated the same thing again, and it is just surplus. I mean, why if half-cocked necessarily is going to be between those two positions, there is nothing beyond the boundaries. Half-cocked has to be somewhere in the middle, and so to say
every time they wanted to refer to that position, they didn't want to say intermediate said fully cocked position and said striking position, so that's why they defined it as half-cocked.
Well, then they should have been clear in their definition, because there is no evidence that this has an understood meaning. They should have defined it if they intended it to be defined, because this court has said it has to be clear and deliberate if you're going to act as your own lexicographer.
Okay.
But I see that I've already...
We'll give you 3 minutes back, and we'll add 3 minutes to your opposing counsel's argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Doug Spears here on behalf of Salo, Inc. They do business as Car Arms, and if you're a gun person, that's the name that you would recognize if you've been looking at weapons and firearms in a store.
Let me ask you, terms of the whole implications for this, if we disagree with you and find that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in refusing to allow you to amend the claims to add, or amend your pleadings to add an infringement claim, then why does it matter if we agree or disagree with respect to the claim construction issues?
Well, it probably doesn't, except for this. The more central part of the issues that we're raising on our cross appeal is that Judge Antone's final judgment that he entered isn't a declaratory relief judgment.
Well, I understand that, but if in fact, are there other products that could still be charged with infringement?
Yes, ma'am.
You need to maintain these claim constructions with respect to those other products?
Certainly. There are two products that we tried to add to this lawsuit that it was ruled we were after the time period and therefore they were not allowed that we filed separate suits on, the DB9 and the DB320.
Okay, so there's been no declaratory judgment, no at least that the court didn't believe that it entered declaratory judgment as to those products.
That's correct. The court at this point certainly is of the position, and it's very clear in the record what the judge was doing when he did not enter a judgment that declared the relationships of the parties. He merely entered a judgment that said, well, because we didn't let you amend, I can't enter a judgment that says there's infringement because, in my view, you never asked for that.
Have you filed suit on those other products?
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. And they've been stayed pending this.
Okay. But the judgment is essentially no invalidity and no non-infringement.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever seen a declaratory judgment entered that
and
way.
And you're not going to get those other two accused guns in this case if it goes back. If we, for example, decided that the claim construction was wrong in whole or in part, for example, if we said, well, spring compression is required, so we'd send it back for another trial on the infringement issue, maybe not for validity. But you're not going to be able to bring those two. You're blocked from bringing those products into this case.
Based on the rulings of the court as they stand now.
You might want to bring another case, and then you're worried about a collateral estoppel effect from the claim construction.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. Is it your position that...
He's worried about collateral estoppel on the claim
construction.
Yes, both are. Okay. So are these issues, these claim constructions, determinative? In other words, if we say that some spring compression is necessary to have any cocking, regardless whether it's half or intermediate, do you agree that there would be no infringement?
No, ma'am, because that issue, as discovery proceeded and in the testimony at trial, I'm drawing a blank on his name, their principal engineer in-house and the man who runs the manufacturing conceded that float that Mr. Santuri talked about disappeared. That there was no float, and so there was the possibility of spring compression during various times of the manufacturing process of this product. So no, I don't think that in and of itself.
In the manufacturing process, as opposed to the gun that's completed in the store.
No, what's completed and in the store. The way it's manufactured and produced and put in the store, there was contact.
The product, not the manufacturing process.
Correct. I misspoke. The product that ends up in the store would be an infringing product.
Okay, let's talk about this cocking and releasing element versus the spring compression. The cocking and releasing element is only on one side of the striker, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So how can you be cocked without having at least compress the spring to some extent?
Remember the travel of the striker is between the striking and the fully cocked position. As their product demonstrates, you can move that striker back in the course of its travel, which is the cocking motion, without sometimes having spring compression. What is behind, the reason the cocking and releasing element maintains it in the half-cocked position, as described in the 914 patent, is because that is what prevents that striker from moving forward to the first position under any circumstance. For instance, if there was no spring compression at all, the thing was actually floating, the way they say. If you point it at the ground, the cocking and releasing mechanism still keeps it in the half-cocked position, still maintains it in that position, won't let it go forward. Gravity can't even pull it forward. So it doesn't require spring compression to actually do that. It's merely maintaining that position in the course of its travel from striking to fully cocked.
Show me what in the written description tells me that you don't need spring compression.
Spring compression is not mentioned. It is not mentioned in any way, shape, or form. And that's why we say that it's not.
Let's start with the diagrams. I mean, the diagrams show spring compression, right?
Yes, ma'am, but the diagrams, of course, are merely illustrative and don't impact the claims.
I agree, but then when you describe the diagram, you say, let's look at column 3, starting at line 13. In the half-cocked position, the striker does not possess, in theory, enough energy to detonate the primer if it releases at that point.
Yes, ma'am.
Referring again to 5, striker tongue 26 rests on the first cam lobe of cam 22, and cam 22 is prevented from rotating. So are you saying that the releases at that point has nothing to do with the spring compression?
If there was no spring compression at that point, it would not have enough energy to detonate the primer. That does not refer to spring compression. That merely says that the gun is in a safe position in terms of its ability to detonate the primer if it is released improperly.
Well, isn't it the compressed spring that ultimately provides the energy?
It can. Also, it could be gravity, as I gave my example. If there's no energy being imparted to it, then it meets that definition.
So it may or may not have spring pressure.
May or may not. Doesn't have to. It's merely intermediate, the fully cocked and the striking position.
Do you agree that cocked has to have some spring compression?
No, sure. I think a cocked refers to the full range of travel of the striker, and therefore I think it's possible to have that striker move back, but not yet be under spring compression. And that's what their design tried to do.
Does cocked mean ready to fire?
Sir?
Doesn't cocked mean ready to fire?
Fully cocked does, yes, sir.
Fully cocked. So it's fully cocked and it's ready to fire and you pull the trigger.
Yes, sir.
How is it going to detonate unless the spring is what propels the striker forward?
Absolutely agree with you. Fully cocked, it has to be under spring compression. Absolutely.
So there's a difference between half-cocked, cocked, and fully cocked.
Yes, sir.
Where does the patent teach me that?
It teaches you that by defining what half-cocked is in this particular
patent. Without telling me what cocked or fully cocked is.
Correct. Fully cocked, nobody...
So this is a patent that only deals with half-cockedness?
It is a patent that deals on.
I wouldn't say it.
and I laugh, Judge, because I made that comment to the trial court in the Markman hearing that everybody has used the term half cock at some point or other. But This patent deals with a particular means of cocking and firing a firearm. And it has, as part of that, a particular position, which is important in this design, where the striker is maintained at a position that is somewhere in the intermediate portion of the travel of that striker, but is not yet able to fire. And it teaches you that in the express language.
It may be retained in that position with cooperation of a spring, and it may not.
Correct.
In your view.
Correct. It may not. And so, that's
so you say that if you put it down, gravity won't, the cocking and releasing element. What if you put it this way? What happens?
The back of the weapon is there's an open chamber. Now at that point, maybe it slides back. Maybe it hits a spring. Maybe it hits the back. But it cannot advance to the first position. It's maintained in that half cock by the cocking and releasing mechanism.
And that's the 22.
I believe so. The first Campbell of 22, yes. That's what engages.
And there's a spring associated with that cam, right? But that's spring 38.
Correct. You know, this is what made the discussion regarding the Glock weapon so interesting in the trial. Is the diametrical opposing difference between those two designs. Mr. Glock's weapon, his trigger mechanism, first of all, is not a cam. It's a combination of two levers. His spring that he has a spring in there too, but his assists the trigger pull, makes it a very light trigger pull. Can make it a hair trigger pull if you want it to. Carr's weapon is exactly the opposite. That spring that's referred to that we've been talking about, it's pushing against the trigger pull. It's pushing towards the actual trigger. It's resisting the pull, making it a true double action weapon as opposed to a single action firearm. What has puzzled me about this case is the manner in which the district court treated the entry of the final judgment. Clearly, the rule of civil procedure require that a judgment entered by the court grant all the relief to any party that the findings require, even if the party hasn't asked for that relief.
Well, they have to ask for something. I mean, that sort of focuses on what your prayer for relief is. You have to have. You can't just walk into court and make a prayer for relief. You have to have claims, affirmative claims, and that's the problem here, isn't it? That you had a prayer for relief, but you never asserted affirmative claims.
Well, that's certainly the way the trial court ruled, and we argued that was not an appropriate ruling. And whether you judge it de novo or whether you judge it as abuse of discretion, I think the key problem is that the court didn't appreciate, or that's not a correct term, didn't take into consideration appropriately what the express purpose of the Declaratory Relief Act is. It is to declare the jural relations between the parties, to resolve a dispute, to give clarity to what their positions are. The judgment entered here
didn't do any of that. Why didn't that happen? I mean, the declaratory judgment plaintiff here went in and said, I'd like two declarations. I'd like a declaration that my product's not infringing a Clark's patent. And I also like a declaration that Clark's patent is invalid on a number of grounds. Right?
Yes, sir.
And the district court judge says, I'm denying your motion.
Judge, I think at that point, he's really treating it as to whether or not he's going to take jurisdiction in the first place. Because he's not declaring the rights of the parties.
But what he's doing is he's dealing with the case or controversy that's in front of him, which in his view is, at this stage in the game, a one-sided case or controversy in terms of who's promoting legal theories.
And that's an interesting question, because how do you have a one-sided case or controversy?
Well, there's lots of instances where there's a declaratory judgment that's requested, and that the declaration in and of itself is what the case is all about. And, you know, you could choose to not bother to bring an infringement claim, or you could bring an infringement claim. But you didn't choose to bring an infringement claim.
And, again, respectfully, we think we did, at least in terms of a colorable claim by including the prayer for relief that we did. Obviously,
how does a prayer for relief state facts upon which a claim can be granted?
Judge, I'll concede that it did not. However, looking at form over substance is a
but
mystery.
But isn't that the problem here? I mean, you can, as my colleague said, you can just oppose a declaratory judgment action, or you can bring a counterclaim. But you can't just oppose and then implicitly say the counterclaim was raised. Don't you have to bring it under the rules of procedure?
And, Judge, we think we did. Because all
but you just said that there were no facts pled that would state a claim.
Because they had all been pled in infinite detail by the plaintiff.
Well,
there were no additional facts to
why
plead.
Why didn't you at least incorporate them and say, I mean,
hindsight 2020? I agree.
Well,
with
rules of civil procedure 2020. I mean, it seems a little problematic to lead the district court guessing as to whether you're making a claim for infringement or not when your answer doesn't include one.
And if there had been a motion to strike or a motion to dismiss.
What was there to strike? I mean, they didn't know you were putting forth a counterclaim.
Yes, they did. Yes, sir, they did.
But you just conceded that you didn't plead any facts to support one.
I conceded that according to the pleading rules, perhaps the pleading was defective. But they did clearly know that we were putting forth a counterclaim because they questioned Mr. Moon about it and about his damages in his deposition. They very clearly knew there was a counterclaim. They chose to wait, not do anything about it, and then try to beat it at the end, and they succeeded. They played the game, and they rolled the dice, and they won. But there is no surprise here. That is absolutely refuted by the record. I see I'm within my rebuttal time, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
We'll give you your time back. We'll restore your full 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask you the practical question. So, assuming we reverse on claim construction.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's still no new trial as to these products if we affirm as it relates to the cross appeal, correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. However, as Mr. Spears mentioned, there are two other cases that have been filed against a related entity and against the president of the company to bring in additional firearms. And long ago when they moved to amend, we indicated to the court in the pleadings, we don't really care about the additional firearms because the mechanisms were relatively, I mean, they're almost the same. However, the real issue that we raised and that was raised and I think understood by the court was that at the time that there was a motion to amend, there were only 6 weeks until we had expert reports and not a single bit of discovery had been done on damages, on market conditions.
Right, but I guess my ultimate question is that this case would be over. The impact of our reversal on a claim construction is something that would have to be addressed in the other case.
I believe so, Your Honor, but I don't. I think if the court affirms the district court's decision, then I think that they will have two other actions that they will may be able to move forward on, depending on how preclusion impacts it. I'm not sure how the facts play out in those because there is a little bit of difference between the DB9 that he mentioned and the DB380. So
you're concerned that you'd be saddled with a claim construction with which you disagree?
Yes, Your Honor, and we would have to fight a second round of litigation with a claim construction.
You think you'd be stopped on the claim construction, which is why you want to get it upset?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not because you need it. You don't need it in this case.
Right.
If we agree that your adversary didn't properly get his infringement claim in the case, then for these products, past infringement's over and the patents expire.
Correct, Your Honor.
Nothing going forward.
If there's no claim for damages on these products and the court affirms the claim construction, yes, then these products are effectively done. And we have to, you know, depending on how preclusion plays out, we have to fight the battle with the other two
litigations that they filed with the other two firearms that.
But on the claim construction, if it's changed, you want another declaratory judgment trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because you'd like to be able to prove non-infringement.
Yes, Your Honor.
But you wouldn't have a case of controversy as to these products anymore, would you?
Well, if the claim construction were reversed, then I believe that we still, well, if the claim construction is reversed, but the damages claim is affirmed, then no, we wouldn't have a, I don't believe we would have a case or controversy with respect to these products, but there would be with the other two sets of products.
So the controversy in the district court as a result of this appeal is going to be mooted.
If the court affirms the denial of the motion to amend, then
that's
yes.
What I mean. Either way on the claim construction.
Right. It would effectively end this case, but there are two other cases.
So would you be entitled to a new trial, new declaratory judgment trial, in which your adversary can't participate, blocked out, if we change the claim construction? If we agree that partial tension, partial compression is necessary.
For these products or for the ones in the other cases?
Either way.
With respect to these, I think there would still be a question as to whether these products infringe. I still think there would be a case or controversy if the claim construction's changed. Now, there's no damages, and then there's a question of whether there's
no
damages.
There's no damages, and there's no injunction.
Right.
So what's at stake?
Well, there's still a question of infringement. Now, if they still contend that those infringe even under the court's,
but if they're
revised,
out, if they don't have any skin in the game.
Right.
There's
nothing they can do. I mean, they say, oh, my God, the products are infringed, but there's no remedy.
That's true. I think
well,
if there's no...
Does that moot the controversy?
I believe it would with respect to these products, not with respect to the other ones.
I think that's right. What the presiding judge is trying to get at, is what's happening here in terms of... It wouldn't make sense for us to order a district court judge to have another declaratory judgment trial, one-sided trial.
If
there's no relief.
Right. If there's no relief available, then you're right, Your Honor. But it does have implications in the other cases.
Right, but that would be essentially an advisory opinion in this case, wouldn't it?
Well, I think certainly the court in the other two cases is going to take a look at how this court rules.
You're going to be bound?
It depends on how the court decides the relationship between the parties is.
Let's say we decide that since the motion to amend the judgment and to add counterclaims was properly denied, that there's no case or controversy with regard to the declaratory judgment action, and we just don't address the claim construction issue. If we just affirm based, can we do that? Can we affirm based on the denial of the motion to amend?
You could, but I think that certainly for purposes of judicial economy, we'd have...
No. I don't want to hear the judicial economy argument. I mean, I know you want us to decide the claim construction in your favor so you can tell the district court, but that's an advisory opinion. Do you think we can affirm, or do we have to reach your declaratory judgment appeal? It seems to me that it's a little bit of a hard question, but that if we agree that they didn't preserve any damages or an injunction claim because they didn't include a counterclaim, then it doesn't really matter what we say on the claim construction for this case. And you may have arguments to go back on the other case.
What happens if we write an opinion that said, because we agree that your adversary is blocked out here, this case is mooted, and we express no view on the claim construction arguments presented to us?
Well, then this case is probably over, and we go to the other two cases.
That's right. Then what's the estoppel effect going to be in future cases for this claim construction?
It'll depend on the relationship that the court decides between the entities and principles of Diamondback that have been. So in the other two cases.
So if the district court, I suspect your problem is you think the district court is going to refuse your claim construction again and rule against you, but you would still have a free opportunity to appeal that claim construction to us in the other case, wouldn't you?
That's true. We would conceivably get a set. Assuming this court affirms the denial of the motion to amend, affirms the denial of injunction, affirms the denial of destruction of product, then I think that would likely resolve all the issues in this case, and we would go back and have to fight over the relatedness between Diamondback Firearms, the party here, and the named defendants in the other two actions, and yes, then we would go forward. However, I'm not...
Should we be concerned about jurisdiction, about cases and controversies and mootness?
Well, certainly the court always is.
We're having an open discussion here, but it just seems to me that there is a problem because of what's happened with regard to the motion to amend the pleadings.
Well, I still believe that the court can reach, it's a question of law, I still believe that this court can reach a decision on claim construction and reverse it. Now, it may end up that if the court finds in our favor on claim construction and affirms the denial of the motion to amend, that it goes back for further proceedings, which is to say basically that the conceivably judgments in our may go in our favor. I think it would still have to go back to the trial court to decide whether the evidence as it was presented at trial establishes infringement under the new claim construction.
I'm a little confused by this, but assume we get rid of all the invalidity stuff. If you go back on infringement alone, the most you're going to get is a declaration that the products covered by this lawsuit don't infringe.
Correct.
And you can't get any... I mean, that's where they're in already because they can't get any damages because they didn't properly counterclaim for them.
That's correct, Your Honor, though there is a question of they still have pending motions for fees and those sorts of things, and of course that may be impacted by how the court rules in this case.
Okay.
The thing that I think we're not focused on that I want us to focus on is the right of a prevailing party in a declaratory relief action to seek further relief after the declaratory judgment. If I even conceded that the ruling on the motion to amend was within the court's discretion, I don't concede that, but even if I did, certainly this court's rulings in the various cases that have been used to cut off the right to damages in this case do say that the prevailing party in a declaratory relief action can, inside the same action, seek damages for infringement after judgment, having never pled it. The Polymer case says that directly. What you can't
do—that's the declaratory judgment plaintiff. What do you do with our case law that says if there's a declaratory judgment of non-infringement or of invalidity, that an infringement claim is a compulsory counterclaim?
It's a compulsory counterclaim and cannot be brought in a separate action, but can be brought inside the same action by subsequent relief, is what Polymer says. Polymer said that they try to do it in a separate action. Can't do that.
Right,
but you could have.
With respect to the same action, it's still up to the discretion of the court at what point in time you have to assert that.
Well, certainly there was no assertion here that we didn't do it timely. We did it by trying to seek to have the judgment read in a fashion that allowed us to do that. And the court affirmatively, on the record, said what you're trying to do is run around our ruling on the amendment. It's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to enforce our rights that exist under 2202. 2202 allows for that subsequent relief, and we ought to be able to pursue it. And we were doing it immediately. There was no question of wrong timing.
When did you actually assert 2202 as the grounds for relief?
We asserted that in both in our motion to amend the final judgment and in the motion for injunctive relief.
In your motion to amend final judgment, but
yes,
not
ma'am.
in your motion to amend your answer.
Not in the motion to amend the pleadings, no ma'am. No, ma'am. Because we weren't seeking subsequent.
Show me where in the record that is.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have that noted in front of me. I only have it in my notes, I don't believe. But I could certainly direct you to it and submit that.
Okay, why don't you do that?
Okay.
All right, any other questions? Okay. Any last thoughts? Your time is up?
No, ma'am.
Okay.